It's time for us to begin. If you would please open your Bibles to Psalm 37. Psalm 37. I want to cover several verses, believe it or not, in the chapter this time. I see the doubt on every one of your faces. You don't think we're going to do it, but we're going to try. Psalm 37. This is a fascinating psalm. In our study, we have noted that this psalm is particularly about the security of those who are willing to trust in the things that God has said. The first part of this, in fact, the first eight verses, I find quite interesting. We'll not reiterate that, but the writer is simply pointing out, don't become angry. And, of course, the word is to translated fret or to burn with vexation. We're going to look at that as we get a little further along in our study. And we've talked about that from the perspective of the psalm. Fret not, verse 1, thyself because of the evildoers. Now, we studied from Psalm 37, and we noted that that was the problem that Asaph was having. He looked upon those who were evildoers, and everything seemed to be fine with them. And in our last study, I asked the question to the class, does that bother you when you see some that seem to be evildoers and thieves and thugs and those who just do bad things, and everything seems to be going okay in their life as far as our perspective is concerned, and here we're trying to do what's right, and we become victims and all, and it's frustrating. And who doesn't feel that way from time to time? But if we become so sidetracked by the so-called inequities that we face in life that we forget about the kind of life that we're trying to live and the blessings that God affords to those who are righteous, then we've missed the point. We've just missed the point. And granted, when we look at our own lives, and all of us have had experiences that were just horrible, tragic, sometimes we reflect on that, much like Job, and we get discouraged, and everybody's telling us it's all your fault if you'd change. Well, not necessarily, and that's what Job's friends did. And so we don't want to be like that. We don't want to be so discouraged that all we see is the evil that seems to encompass our life, and then the blessings that seem to be afforded those that we acknowledge are evildoers. So we can't make that which is crooked straight. And the wisdom writer pointed that out in Ecclesiastes. But our point here is, as we summarize these first eight verses, when you look at the fellow that's doing bad things and he seems to prosper, things seem to be going okay, don't let that cause you to be angry. The text tells us in verse 8, cease from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not thyself, it tendeth only to evil doing. And then he begins to elaborate on the judgment of those who are evil. Now, let me stress this point from this passage. We looked at it last time somewhat, and I want to stress it because that, in my judgment at least, is the focal point of this text. When he says, cease from anger and forsake wrath, fret not thyself, it tendeth only to evil doing. When you look at the evildoer and see how he prospers, and that makes you mad. And we've talked about where we generally go when we get mad, and it's not a good place, is it? And so the point is, if we go there because we see the evildoer seeming to prosper, and we let that make us so angry, what does that make you? It makes us the evildoer. So we've become the very person that we claim that we don't like. And so that's the point that we want to see. Linda, I can tell from that look, your wheels are turning.
Well, I don't know how much we could fall into being an evildoer, but I don't know that being angry makes us an evildoer.
Not in and of itself, but sometimes it leads us to that. And it depends on what makes us angry, too. Just simply being angry on occasion can cause us to be the evildoer. Depends on what makes us angry. So that's a point that needs to be explained perhaps a little bit further. We looked at this passage, I think, in our last study. And again, I think it's a profound text that we need to keep in mind. A fool uttereth all his anger, but a wise man keepeth it back and stilleth it. When we allow things to stir us, and then sometimes we begin to talk or we begin to act, and that becomes the motivation, how many of us make some very tragic mistakes while we're in that state of mind? And so what do we want to do? We want to do what he says. When we allow this to upset us, we want to get ourselves under control, because self-control is one of the virtues that Peter says we have to have if we're going to be richly supplied an entrance into the eternal kingdom. Now, I want to lay alongside of Psalm 37 another psalm, Psalm 46. And we'll not read all of it. It's only 11 verses, but we'll try to get the gist of it from the first three verses. In verse 1, 2, and 3 of Psalm 46, the writer said, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore will we not fear, though the earth do change, and though the mountains be shaken to the heart of the seas, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains tremble with the swelling thereof. Now, what's the substance of what the psalm says in that passage? I think there is quite a contrast. God is our refuge. He is our strength. He's there to help us in times of trouble. Now, does that just mean when, you know, you get up in the morning and the coffee pot don't work?
It means when everything around you is in chaos.
Well, yeah. Look at the illustration. He said, therefore we will not fear though the earth do change. I mean, we're not talking about just minor little upsets in life. We're talking about major tragedies. And God is my help during these times. Though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains tremble with the swelling. We're not talking about just something that makes my day go south. We're talking about some major upsets to life. And if we forget the source of our strength during those times, we're not going to succeed. So anger is not going to help us. Who will? God will, and peace is not achieved by looking at this fellow over here that's practicing sin, and we say, well, his life seems to be blessed, is it? Well, see, sometimes all of that can just be deceptive. You know, we sometimes use the expression, the grass seems greener on the other side, until you go on the other side. Randy?
Well, we also know that God causes the sun to shine on the evil and the good, and
yeah,
blesses the evil and the good. But there's also, I don't know if you can call it blessing, but there's, you know, what we refer to as filthy lucre. People who make money by being evil.
Yeah.
There's a lot of money to be made by being evil, and of course money and translates into extreme wealth. And we see a lot of extremely wealthy people, not all of them done it in horrible ways, but some did.
Yeah.
And some people we know.
Yeah.
Acquired a lot of money by doing evil things.
Yes. They acquired a lot of money, but that don't make their life pleasant.
Well, I don't mind. Some of them have.
Yeah, but it generally don't last. And that brings us essentially to this next point. Anger really don't bring the comfort that we're looking for. And of course, the fretting, the anger, the vexation is what he's talking about. This is a passage that we're all familiar with, I would like to think. In Proverbs 13:15, the writer says, good understanding giveth favor, but the way of the transgressor is hard. Now, let's let that hit bottom. The way of the transgressor is hard. We've all had the experience, have we not? Trying to help somebody whose life is just a wretched mess. And they often don't listen, and maybe we have studied certain passages of Scripture, and we try to offer this as some means of condolence to the fellow, and he keeps in a state of bewilderment because he keeps making bad choices and bad decisions, and he don't know why these consequences are imposed, why he has to suffer these things, and he's seeking for something better, but the familiar text of Jeremiah 10:23, the way a man is not in himself to direct his own steps. And here's a fellow, he's not going to read the Bible. He's not going to be concerned about what God says is right or wrong. I'm going to do this on my own. And then I keep, as we've used the illustration so many times, with the big gorilla behind the door, we keep winding up back here on our back, and we're wondering, well, why is this working out so well? Well, the way of the transgressor is hard. And I wish I could communicate that successfully as much as I would like. Yes, sometimes we look at the lives of wicked people and things seem to be going well for them. But eventually that's not going to work out, because there is the time of accounting, and that's not going to work out. And often, more often I would say than not, when we look at the life of the transgressor, who doesn't care about right or wrong or how he treats others or any of those kind of things, there's turmoil in his life that you may not know about, that he's not happy with, but he's not seeking the right solution. So the way of the transgressor is hard, but if you want to have favor, then get a good understanding. And how do you do that? Well, you got to put your nose in the book. I like the way you say that. Another passage that we want to tie with this thought is from Ecclesiastes chapter 10. Ecclesiastes chapter 10, beginning in verse 16. He said, "Woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child and thy princes eat in the morning. Happy art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles, and thy princes eat in due season for strength and not for drunkenness. By slothfulness the roof sinketh in, and through idleness of the hands the house leaketh." That sound familiar, Mom? So there you are. A feast is made for laughter, wine maketh glad of the life, and so forth. But our point is that getting angry, and sometimes angry leaders do more harm than to do good. And so the point is in verse 6, "Woe unto thee, O land, when thy king is a child and the princes eat in the morning. Happy art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles." What's his point? Young versus nobles. That's the contrast. What's the point?
Is it young versus noble or maturity versus...
Yeah, the latter. The latter, yeah. Yeah. When you've got maturity, in fact, figured into this picture, then we see that somebody that behaves like a child, that they don't wind up blessing the people. It becomes a curse to them. And that's the point, essentially, that's made throughout the 37th Psalm. So, right, you're right on target. Let's pursue this thought a little from the 37. Get back over here to it. I'm in the wrong chapter. Psalm 37, in verse 9. Now, having introduced this thought in verse 8, "Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not thyself. It tendeth only to evil doing." If anger rules, then the likelihood is you're going to do some really bad things. You'll suffer the consequence. You'll become the evil doer. Now, what's the consequence of that? Verse 9. "For evildoers shall be cut off, but those that wait for Jehovah, they shall inherit the land." Now, depending on what translation you're reading from, you might be reading, "They shall inherit the earth." I had some folks from Jehovah's Witness movement come to my door one day. And they wanted to know if I wanted to live on a perfect earth. And this was kind of the context that they were showing me, that those who are righteous will inherit the earth. Well, in this setting, who's writing this? Was he talking about literally inheriting the earth? Is the earth going to be my eternal dwelling place?
I hope not.
The point is that if you want to be blessed, then you do the things that are right. There's an inheritance for those who do right things. And in this particular instance, I think he's talking primarily about the nation of Israel. You do the things that are right, and there's blessings involved in it. You do the things that are wrong, and you become the object of God's wrath. It's a very simple concept. And why don't we wrap our minds around that? So here's the problem. And he continues in verse 10. He said, "For yet a little while, and the wicked shall not be. Yea, thou shalt diligently consider his place, and he shall not be." Now, the wicked man who seems to be prospering, even as we look at Asaph in Psalm 73, Asaph was perplexed about this because the wicked doing ugly things over here. He seems to have a good life, and here I am trying to do the right things, and every way I turn it seems to be ugly. Until what? Until I went into the house of the Lord. And then I discerned that there's consequences going to happen to these folks over here that pursue an evil course. Now, what about the good things? You see, when we look in Revelation chapter 6, we've studied this beginning in verse 9. You remember those souls that have been beheaded for the cause of Christ and they're crying out from under the altar? And what's their question? How long is this going to continue? And what's the answer? Just a little while. A little while. So what seems at this point to be the victory for the evildoer and for the fellow that's doing right, what seems like to be an eternal loss to him, it's not really that way. Because the evildoer's victory is not going to last much longer. It'll be just for a little while. And then what will happen to the righteous? They'll be vindicated. They'll be vindicated. Now that's what the book of Revelation essentially is about. And that's what the psalmist is telling us here in Psalms 37, beginning in verse 10. He said, "Yea, thou shalt diligently consider his place, and he shall not be." But, oh, you mean there's a but to this? Yeah, there is. Yeah, well, what's that? "The meek shall inherit the land, and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace." Does that sound familiar to you? "The meek shall inherit the earth." Where we read that? It's right here in Matthew chapter 5 and then verse 5. In the Beatitudes, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." You can compare that with Psalm 119 if you like. But the spiritual descendants of Abraham, who's that? The spiritual descendants of Abraham. Well, that's folks that are Christians. Those who are children of God. Those who are baptized into Christ, enjoying the remission of their sins. What do they have? Well, what's the whole subject in Ephesians chapter 2 between the relationship of the Jew and the Gentile and their relationship with God? It's peace, fellowship. Yeah. You can have peace with God and you can have peace with each other. You have fellowship with God, you have fellowship with each other, to use that word. And that's the point that is being established. So what you have as a spiritual descendant of Abraham, even though things may not be seemingly going your way right now, is you have the hope of the abundance of peace. Now, that's not a hard concept, is it? And so I think this psalmist is very encouraging to us. In verses 12 and 13, he said, "The wicked," now notice how we go back and forth, "the wicked plotteth against the just and gnasheth upon him with his teeth. The Lord will laugh at him, for he seeth that his day is coming." Does that sound familiar? Now let's not make light of that expression, because I know sometimes we use it and we use it in a wrong sense. We look at somebody whose life is wicked and somebody who's injured us to a great degree, and our attitude is with a smile, "Well, his day will come. He'll get his." Well, we're talking about vindictiveness, vengeance. But we also know that vengeance is not ours to take. Vengeance belongs to the Lord, and he will recompense, but it's not something that we should necessarily delight in. The Lord will laugh at him, for he seeth his day is coming. Now, how is that? Somebody explain to me. How is it that the Lord will laugh at him? Yeah, Randy?
Well, I don't really have the answer, but I have a reference. It reminds me of Psalm 2.
Yeah.
When, well, in context, you have to get into verse 2. "In the case of the earth, take their stand, and the moon take their counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he will speak to them in his anger and terrify them in his fury, saying, but as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain."
Yeah.
I don't get the feeling that he's laughing because something's funny.
No.
He's scoffing.
Okay.
The Lord is scoffing at those who are so proud they think they can go up against God and win.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's look at this passage in Ezekiel. Yeah. Well, it is. That's the point. Look, turn over, if you will, to this text of Ezekiel chapter 21. Ezekiel chapter 21. Let's begin the reading at verse 24. The Old Testament prophet says, "Therefore, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, because ye have made your iniquity to be remembered, and that your transgressions are uncovered, so that in all your doings your sins do appear, because that ye are come to remembrance, ye shall be taken with the hand. And thou, O deadly, wounded, wicked one, one, the prince rather of Israel, whose day has come in the time of the iniquity of the end. Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, remove the mitre and take off the crown. This shall be no more the same. Exalt that which is low and abase that which is high. I will overturn it. This also shall be no more until he whose right hand is, and I will give it him. Now what is the Lord saying to those who are wicked? Your day has come. Now is there pleasure? And I was looking for the passage also in Ezekiel, and I am not finding it readily. I thought I had it on my chart, but I don't think that I do, unless it's... No, that's not it either. Where the Lord does not take delight in punishing the evildoer. So you're right. This is not funny. There's no smirk about this. But the irony is the evildoer thinks I've done this and I've gotten by with it. And no, you're not getting by with anything. Because with the evildoer, his day will come. There's always a day of reckoning. Always. So the evildoer is not getting by with anything. Now with that assurance from these other passages as well as our text, the Lord sees that his day is coming. What should that do for you?
Well, it should comfort us.
Yeah, when we're looking at our suffering and persecution and all that, and the fellow over here is doing evil things, and we think, well, everything's good with him. He's going to get by with it. No, he's not going to get by with it. Ultimately, his day is coming, and there's no delight in punishing the evildoer, but that day will come. And the irony, and I think you're right, the Lord will laugh at him because he thinks he's getting by with it. And he's not getting by with anything. Because the Lord has said, I'm going to take care of that. You saw that in verse 27 of Ezekiel 21. I will overturn it. I will. Now that's a pretty declarative statement. I'll do it. Now, here's the question. Here we are trying to do right things. Okay. Do we suffer when we do right things? Well, Paul said to Timothy in 2 Timothy 3:12. That if you live godly, what's going to happen? You're going to suffer persecution. That's just the way of it. So, what do you do when you look at the man that seems to be prospering and you see him as a threat to you? Or get mad about it, right? Sit down and moan and groan because of our plight and feel sorry for ourselves? No. You see, the question is, who art thou that thou shouldest be afraid of a man that shall die? You see, this evildoer that appears to be a threat to me and my attitude or a threat to me physically, what's going to ultimately happen to him? He's going to die. And then what's going to happen to him? His day will come.
But you've got to be careful that he doesn't cause you to be in the same boat.
That's the point.
And that's a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah. That's the point. I can't let him cause me to do bad things. Because he's going to face the same God that I do, and he'll be judged by the same standard. Other passages, I think, complement that, but that's a legitimate question. Who art thou that thou shouldst be afraid of a man that shall die? What's the worst he can do to you? Well, he can kill you, but that's the worst he can do, isn't it? But what can God do to him? This is Matthew 10:28 we're looking at.
What verse is that?
Well, I thought it was Isaiah 51. It may not be. I may have it wrong on my chart. I don't recall. That's one of the perils of preparing material ahead. Go back and study it, but I forgot where that one come from. Isaiah 51, verse 7. No, that complements that passage.
Whose heart is in my law, fear ye not the
reproach
of men, neither be dismayed at their
beatings, revelings. Yeah, and you're reading that from where, huh?
59 and 7,
okay. Okay, that's 7 through 13. Yeah, that's still not the passage I thought I had on the board.
57? What chapter are you on?
51, Isaiah 51.
You said
59. No. Well, I may have said that, but that wasn't what I was looking at. I have learned sometimes that I don't always say what I thought I said. 51:12, that's the passage I got on the board. Thank you. 51:12.
I, even I, am he that comforteth you. Who art thou that thou art afraid of man that shall die?
There it is.
And of the Son of Man that shall be made as something.
Okay. All right. So that is from this passage, Isaiah 51:7-13. All right. Thank you.
51:7
isn't 51? It's 51:12. 7-13 is the context. Richard will tell you, I sometimes do ... instead of writing it all out there, but there it is. The verse is verse 12. Thank you. ... It's not. You removed the ... from the printout. Well, all right. Well, you didn't find the passage that I referenced that I thought I had in my notes. I think it's in Ezekiel that the Lord hath no pleasure. He doesn't delight in the suffering of the wicked.
12 and 13 together there in Isaiah 51. That really kind of slams home the point.
Yeah.
12 and 13, at least the New American Standard reads this way: I, even I, am he who comforts you. Who are you that are afraid of man who dies, and of the Son of Man who is made like grass, that you have forgotten the Lord your Maker, who stretched out the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth? So it's the contrast.
Yeah, and keep reading.
That you fear continually all day long because of the fury of the oppressor.
Yeah.
And he who makes ready to destroy. Where is the fury of the oppressor?
Yeah. Yeah. See, all he can do is kill you.
Ezekiel 18:32, for I have no pleasure in the death of him
that dieth. That's it. Ezekiel 18:32. Thank you. I thought I had that on.
And also Ezekiel 33:11 says, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked.
There it is. Yeah, both of those.
And
33:11.
Yeah.
What was the final?
This quotation is from Isaiah chapter 51, verse 12.
Got it.
Okay. And the passages that I thought I had on the chart from Ezekiel are not on the chart, and they are Ezekiel 18:32 and 33:11. Thank you for looking that up. Failed to get those on the chart. All right. Any questions? Comment? All right. Let's look back at our text. Psalm 37, verse 14. He said, the wicked have drawn out the sword and have bent their bow to cast down the poor and needy, to slay such as are upright in the way. The sword shall enter into their own heart, and their bows shall be broken. Now, what's the intent of the evildoer? And he's going to hurt you. He's going to draw his sword and draw back his bow to hurt you. But ultimately, what's going to be happening? Well, it's not going to quite turn out quite like that. The sword's going to penetrate him, and his bow will break. So ultimately, the evildoer is not going to accomplish his purpose. And we've looked at this before and used these very illustrations. We want to look at Proverbs 29, he that is upright in the way is an abomination to the wicked. Well, yeah. Wasn't that the case with Cain and Abel? Why did Cain kill his brother? Well, his brother did what was right, and it made Cain mad. Yeah.
I think it was jealousy.
Yeah.
And also insecurity that he hadn't done his best.
Right. Yeah.
God is aware of that, and yet he's trying to camouflage his self-disdain, for lack of a better word, by being aggressive towards his brother who was doing right.
That's right.
I think sometimes when we get caught up in that space looking at what someone else has done, we neglect to take accountability and ownership of what we haven't done.
Isn't that a sad state of affairs? That you're doing what's right makes me so mad that I could kill you because you've done what's right. Now, as we look back in the New Testament, in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 12, I don't think I have that on the, yeah, I do, 11 and 12, the text tells us, "For this is the message which he heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain was of the evil one, and slew his brother. And wherefore slew he him? Because his works were evil, and his brother's were righteous." Now, why should somebody be, you know, doing things that are good make me so mad that I'd want to hurt him?
Our accountability is not
you. Yeah. Well, something wrong with my way of thinking. When somebody doing good things makes me so mad, I want to hurt them. But that's what happened with Cain, and that's what happened with Saul. You'll note that Saul repeatedly tried to kill David, but he had to admit that David was more righteous than he was. Now, when you look at David's life from the perspective of Saul and seeing him doing good things, he wanted to kill him. And sought to do it several times. And then Haman. We used this illustration in an earlier study of this text. Haman was so mad at Mordecai because Mordecai didn't honor Haman. And Haman was second in command to the king. And because he didn't praise him when he passed by, Haman wants to slaughter a whole nation of people. How do you allow yourself to feel that angry that you want to kill off a whole nation of people because this man's done something that you don't like? And by the way, he did what he should be doing. Haman was not a nice man. And then, of course, we've got the same thing. And I think the more I study, and I know I talk about this way too much, about my study with my friend that is of Jewish background, but the more I talk with him, the more I see the attitude of the people of Jesus' day. They became so angry with Jesus, they became betrayers and murderers. And of course, in our study, the question came up, why did the Jews hate Jesus so much? There's no dispute. I mean, we close up our Bible, and we know from secular history that a man named Jesus of Nazareth walked the earth, and historically, the Jews killed him. That's what they did. Well, why did they become so angry at this man that they would kill him?
Pilate said he knew that they truly voted because of envy.
Yeah, yeah, that's what he said, yeah. Well, the answer, and that's a good question, and the answer that my friend gave me was because he was a troublemaker, but he was a prophet. I said, how can you be a prophet and a liar, stirring the pot with claims to be the Son of God when he really wasn't? He knew it. Of all people, he knew it. Well, he was the Son of God. You see, his claims were factual. But why did the Jews hate him so much? Well, he was a troubler of Israel, like the Old Testament prophet.
You can also think about it from a Jewish perspective. I would think that my whole life I've invested in my religion and my beliefs, and who are you to tell me I'm after all this?
Yeah,
time?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that instead of looking at growth and learning.
Yeah.
Something even better.
Yeah. Well, this is something that's really kind of bugged me for as long as I've had to study with the fellow, because he seems like a good fellow. He seems very knowledgeable of history and a whole lot of things. I mean, he's 90-something years old, but his mind just clears a bell. And the thing that really is disturbing to me is what do you do with the evidence? Now, he has conceded, I'm going to read the book of Matthew. Okay, why? Well, because Matthew was one of the disciples of the Lord, and he addressed this book to Jewish people, and he quotes from what this fellow prefers to call the Hebrew Scriptures. Now, I'm okay with that. He quotes from the Hebrew Scriptures about 36 times. Matthew does that because he's writing to a Jewish audience that should know what the Hebrew Scriptures said, and what's his application? Jesus is the Son of God. He is the Messiah. So when we look at these things, what did Jesus do that was evil for which he was murdered? What crime did he commit?
Well, the answer is he didn't commit any crimes.
No.
The reason that they hated him was because he called them what they were, which was hypocrites.
Yeah.
And he called them hypocrites over and over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, one of the things I'm learning is there's not just one reason why they crucified him. They didn't like him, but the reasons were multiple. He called them hypocrites.
I think ultimately it comes down to his path was not the path that they wanted.
No, no.
You know, it's just No, we can't go that way because that's not what we want.
No,
we want this.
No. And, of course, Jesus talked about their traditions had blinded their minds. And sometimes our own view of something can blind us to the truth. I know that. I've talked with you before about difficulties I had at an earlier age when I was studying math and trig and calculus and all that kind of good stuff. And it don't take very long once you start down that path with the wrong concept, a wrong premise, to where everything's messing up. It's all messing up. And that's what they did. And that's what all of these did. And that's what the psalmist is addressing. So why do you want to start down that path that anger becomes that which leads what you do? Because don't you know that the consequences are severe? And if you let that go, here's where it will lead. We can't do that. We just cannot allow that to happen. Now, Cain said, my punishment is greater than I can bear. And what does that tell us? Well, Cain did what he wanted to, and he was motivated by envy to kill his brother, but did he escape or did his day come? Well, when you look at King Saul that was trying to kill David, and he pursued this path led by his own hatred for David, noting that David's more righteous than I am, where did that lead ultimately for Saul? Did his day come? Well, yeah. And what about Haman? I find this a fascinating illustration. Oh, Haman. Boy, he thought he had things all set. Had the gallows built and everything is good. I'm going to hang Mordecai. But when his evil plot was found out, what happened to him? He got hung and his sons got hung on the same gallows that he had intended for Mordecai. And Mordecai was blessed and promoted to Haman's position. Of course, all the Jews were spared too. There is that. And those who crucified the Son of God, what ultimately occurs with them? Well, we know that 3,000 on that first Pentecost heard the preaching of Peter and they obeyed the gospel. They received the forgiveness of their sin, as great as we might consider it to be. But what about the multitudes that were present on that day that did not obey the gospel? Did their day come? So, in all of these illustrations, these who practice evil things, their day does come. And that's just the way of it. Now, Hosea made this point, and we've looked at it a number of times. For they sow the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. He hath no standing grain, the blade shall yield to the meal, if so be it yield. Strangers yield no meal. If it does, well, strangers will swallow it up. So we see the point being made that is made here in Hosea, made also in the Galatian letter, you reap what you sow, period. And that's the way of it. The evildoer is not the exception. Now, in verses 16, let's go back to our text. Psalm 37, verse 16. Better is a little that the righteous hath than the abundance of many wicked. For the arms of the wicked shall be broken, but Jehovah upholdeth the righteous. Now, you set that in this context, just keep reading, and what do we find? Better is little that the righteous has than the abundance of the wicked. You ever talk to somebody and say, boy, I just wish I had $1 million. If I had $1 million, I'd be the happiest fellow ever lived. Well, now you go over here and look at the fellow that's got $1 million. Is he the happiest fellow that ever lived? That's not the determining factor of happiness, is it? How much you have. That never has been. Pardon me? That's not what Solomon said. No, he said, he that seeks love of silver shall not be satisfied with silver. Always reaching for that next run on the ladder. So we're miserable if that becomes the goal that we're seeking after. You see, the only treasure that can be carried with us is spiritual treasure. We've used the illustration before that not even in California do you see a U-Haul trailer tied on behind a hearse. Don't work that way. Because all the possessions that you accumulate in life, when you die, what happens to them? Well, that's all gone. It becomes that which now belongs to somebody else. In Luke chapter 12, the context of this passage, I think, is interesting, beginning in verse 13. Chris and I have talked about this, Chris Simmons, quite a little bit, that on this occasion, Jesus is presenting a sermon, if you please, to a rather large audience. And the irony is that presenting these grave truths to this large audience, it's interrupted in verse 13. It says, "And one of the multitude said unto him, Teacher, bid my brother divide the inheritance with me." Now, question, can you imagine being in the presence of the Lord and he's teaching you on grave truths that involve your soul, and here you are listening to this and you say, "I want my brother to divide my inheritance. You see to it." What's on this man's mind? The great spiritual truths that Jesus is teaching? Well, he's concerned about money. And look at how Jesus responds. I think it's interesting that he does respond. But look at what he said. He said, "Man, who made me a judge or a divider over you?" Now he's answered the fellow, "I'm not going to do that." But now he goes on teaching and using this as the illustration. What's happened just here? He said, "Take heed and keep yourselves from all covetousness." Now is this just a lesson for these two boys? No, this is for the multitude. They're all hearing this. "Take heed that you keep yourselves from all covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth." And he spake a parable unto them, saying, "The ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully, and he reasoned within himself, What shall I do, because I have not where to bestow my fruits? And he said, This will I do, I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there will I bestow all my grain and my goods, and I will say to my soul, Soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years, take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry." You know, I find this passage incredibly fascinating that's preached to this multitude, because how do we think? Somebody say it, you're all thinking it. How do we think? Just like this fella, right? Just like this rich man. We spend a lifetime accumulating stuff, and then we think, well, now when we reach a certain age, we've got it made, we can take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. You live it up. But you see, there's one thing we don't think about in that equation, and that's the thing the Lord points out. He said, verse 20, "God said unto him, Thou foolish one, this night is thy soul required of thee, and the things which thou hast prepared, whose shall they be?" Now, that's a legitimate question. You spend a lifetime laying up all kinds of treasure, and you die tonight. All right, who's it going to be? It won't be yours anymore. In verse 21, "So is he that layeth up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." Now, the lesson to these two brothers and the lesson to that multitude of people is you need to think about what's important to you. And your soul needs to be more important to you than your inheritance. Your eternal inheritance needs to be what has priority in this equation. You see the same point being made in 1 Timothy chapter 5, or chapter 6, beginning in verse 5, about the man who loves money. He loves money. And so we're not just talking about, it's often misquoted, that money is the root of all this. That's not the problem. The problem is your attitude toward it. You can only have a dollar in your pocket and have a love for it, and now you're in trouble, you see. All right, so the Proverbs amplify this point. You can look at those. Psalms 84, "For a day the courts in thy courts is better than a thousand. I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tents of the wicked." Now that's powerful. I'd rather just be a doorkeeper in the house of God than to dwell in the tents of the wicked or of wickedness. Now, Moses made that choice, didn't he? In Hebrews chapter 11, where had Moses been reared? In Pharaoh's house. I mean, he had great riches. He was the son of Pharaoh's daughter, as it were. That's how he was raised. But the text tells us that he was willing to give all that up and suffer ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. And why? Why would he do that? He saw the promise. He accounted the riches of Christ greater than all that Egypt could produce. And so here is our point. Better is a little that the righteous hath than the abundance of the wicked. And then in verses 18 and 19 of our text, Jehovah knoweth the days of the perfect, and their inheritance shall be forever. They shall not be put to shame in the time of evil, in the days of famine. They shall be satisfied. Now, here comes a point, a method of comparison. Those who are righteous, those who are perfect, I don't understand that to mean without flaw, but those who are righteous, those who are complete, their inheritance shall be forever. Well, where's that inheritance going to be? Laid up in heaven for you, 1 Peter chapter 1, beginning in verse 3. But what about difficulties? You know, times come for even the righteous fellow when things are not so good in his life. But keep in mind, they shall not be put to shame in the time of evil. And in the days of famine, they shall be satisfied. Now, I find this, the wording of this is just incredibly fascinating to me. When the evil day comes, days of famine, time of evil, they shall be satisfied. What does that mean? Well, I think the best explanation for it is seen in this text. If you'll drop down to verse 25, I'm not there yet, but we'll jump ahead. Verse 25 of Psalm 37. The writer says, I have been young and now am old, yet have I not seen the righteous forsaken or his seed begging bread. Now, what's the lesson? Those who are righteous, their inheritance is going to be forever. Well, does that mean evil times won't come? Oh, yeah, evil times come. There may even be times of famine. But what about the righteous? They shall be satisfied. Doesn't mean they're going to have abundance. Don't mean you're going to be rich. You'll have enough. Have enough. And sometimes we're not satisfied with enough. We want to be rich. But we'll have enough. And God promised that, didn't he? Never seen the righteous forsaken, never seen them begging bread. They shall be satisfied. They'll have enough. And we'll see that in our next study as we look at some of these other Psalms. Any questions before we close?